Session number 20894, Reel 1.
Eddie Jones, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Hereford.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did your mother and father both come from Hereford?
Yes.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Hereford?
Yes.
Which school did you go to?
Lord Sudamore Boys' School.
How old were you when you finished there?
14 and a half.
So that was in the later 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I went straight to work in an iron foundry.
Is that what you were doing when war was declared?
Yes.
Had you joined TA before the war?
No.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did.
Under what circumstances?
My father and myself were raising potatoes in the garden when Mother came to the door and said, "You better come in. Mr. Chamberlain's going to make a speech." And my father and myself went into the house and listened to the radio.
How did you feel about the news?
I think I felt that I wouldn't be called up very, straight away because I wasn't old enough. And I'd left the foundry and gone to work on the railway. And a lot of railway people were reserved. But owing to the fact that I didn't join the railway till after the war started, I was not reserved and called up when I was 18 and a half.
Did the war affect you at first in Hereford?
No. There was the big munitions factory, which was about 4 miles from where we live, which was part of the Woolwich Arsenal. The enemy attempted to bomb that on numerous occasions, but it was so well concealed in the bend of a river, and at night there was a fog came up, and it was a natural camouflage, really, and the factory was only hit once with a single bomb in daylight, that was. Only one bomb ever dropped on the factory, which did no damage to the factory, although it did kill the chief of police and his wife because it hit their house.
Were you in Hereford when any bombing occurred?
Yes. Not on the town itself. Mainly, it was bombs dropped in country districts by aircraft trying to get away from this country. There was no concentrated attack on Hereford at all.
Where did the bombs drop in Hereford?
On the outskirts, in the fields.
Do you know the date you joined the army?
Yes. Yes, it was the 21st of January 1942.
So the war had really passed you by in Hereford up till then?
Yes.
Had you been in LDV?
No, I was never in LDV owing to the fact I worked on the railway on shift work.
Can you tell me what happened when you joined the army, please?
Yes, I had to be at Shrewsbury Station by 11 o'clock on the morning. And my father saw me off at Hereford Station. It's about 1 hour's journey to Shrewsbury. And I'll always remember he said to me, as he shook hands and he said goodbye, he said, "Make the best of a bad job." He being a First World War infantryman himself, and he knew that I was going to join an infantry regiment, he knew what I was in for. And we left and I arrived at Shrewsbury, and there was a load of sergeants running around calling out 20th ITC, which was where I was going to. And eventually, I suppose, probably about 50 or 60 of us were marched from the station to Copthorne Barracks, which is about a mile and a half, I suppose, from the station. And we arrived there in time for midday lunch. And I always remember thinking, if this is the way the army feeds you, I'm all for this, because it was an excellent lunch, but it was one of the best we ever had, I think.
What did you have?
I can't remember now. I think it was stew, which was the main ingredient of army life.
So you knew which unit you were going into?
Yes, I went straight into the King Shropshire Light Infantry, because the depot, the Shrewsbury depot, was a joint depot of King Shropshire Light Infantry and North Staffordshire Regiment. And we were mixed up in our actual training and then sent to the various regiments when our training was completed.
What was your basic training like?
Very hard. We did 6 weeks basic training at Shrewsbury, and we weren't allowed out of the camp for the first month. And although we had a very, very good sergeant major, he was a very good man, just the man for the job, really. The training was hard, but I enjoyed the training. And after 6 weeks...
What was so enjoyable about it?
I don't know, the commandery, I think, you know, the comradeship between the various men. We got on very well together. They were a good bunch of lads. And as I say, the NCOs were very good. They were very, very strict, but on the other hand, they were very fair. And I enjoyed the training.
And then?
Then after 6 weeks, I was moved to another barracks, which was known as the Maltings at Shrewsbury, which was a terrible place. It was condemned for people to work in prior to the war. It had been an old flax mill, it had been a malt inns, and the conditions there were absolutely terrible.
In what sense?
The toilets were just outside, just were buckets outside, covered with sacking. There was no hot water. At night, the toilet was a bucket on top of the steps, where there were 75 steps to climb up to our barrack room. And being in training, you'd go up and down these steps probably 20 times a day. And therefore, at night, when you'd finished training, you just didn't have the energy to go out. You just flopped on your bed and stopped there. And as I say, there was a big bucket on top of the stairs, and that was... especially on a Friday night when somebody had been out and had a few drinks of beer, it flowed down the stairs like Niagara Falls next morning. So you just imagine what it was like. This went on for 6 weeks we were there, and then I was sent for by the company commander, who was a very nice man, Captain Keyworth, and asked if I would like to become a Lance Corporal and stop there as an instructor. I'd been in the army then about 3 months. And I asked him if that was a direct order, and he said, no, it's a suggestion. And I said, then I'm not going to take it, sir. I want to get out of this place as fast as I can. And he said, okay, you'd better put in for a specialist course. Well, the specialist courses were motor transport, carriers, mortars, and signals. And me and my three friends opted to go into the signals. And we moved from that barracks to another barracks on the outskirts of Shrewsbury at Halscott, which was a specialist camp. And that was a lovely place. It was like moving from hell into heaven, that was, really was. And we did a 17-week signal course. And after 17 weeks, you had to have the examination to pass out as a signaller.
What kind of signals?
Doing all signals, telephone, radio. We learnt a lot. We learnt semaphore, everything. And you had to pass out at so many words a minute on the Morse code. We all passed the exam eventually, and then we were sent off to our various regiments. And I moved from Shrewsbury to a tented camp just outside Dorchester in Dorset, to the 5th Battalion, King Shropshire Light Infantry. And I was there exactly a month when I was transferred with 50 others from the 5th Battalion to the 4th Battalion, who were then in Westhoff's camp on the Norfolk-Suffolk border, about 6 miles from Brandon. When we got there late at night, and they said to us, well, it's too late to sort you out tonight, so we'll put you down in a barrack room for the night, and they were all Nissen huts. It was in the middle of a very, very big wooded area. And next morning, they got us out, and after breakfast, they started sorting us out, and everybody was going off to their various companies. And there were just four of us left. And the officer who was sorting us out said, what are you for? And I said, signaller, sir. We don't want no signals. And I said, well, that's what we are. We're trained signallers, because we wore cross flags on our arm, of course, you know, after you'd passed it. And he went off and he came back and he said, no, we don't need any signals. He said, but you can go to any of the specialist companies. So me and my three friends, we went to the ACAC platoon. We chose that, yes. And when we got there, they didn't want us. They said, no, we don't want anybody. But we went there and they said, well, there's no room for you to sleep in the hut. And this was now early October now. And so we're going to pitch some tents on the lawn at the side of the hut, which you'll occupy for a few weeks until we can get you sorted out. Well, they did sort us out, but that was March. So we were in the tents all through the winter.
What was that like?
It was very cold. Norfolk's not one of the warmest places in the world, but it was very, very cold there. And one morning we woke up and the tent was right down on your head, and that was snow had fallen and pushed the tent down. And there was no hot water to wash or shave. You washed and shaved in cold water. But eventually the ACAC platoon was broken up. And they said you can go to any of the rifle companies. So we decided, the four of us, that we'd go to the first platoon in the first company, which was 7 Platoon A Company.
7 Platoon?
7 Platoon A Company, yeah.
Why did you choose that?
I don't know, it was just, I said, let's go to the first platoon of the first company, and that was 7 Platoon A Company, and that's where we went.
Why wasn't it called 1 Platoon?
No, the 7 Platoon was the first platoon of the rifle companies. The other platoons were in headquarter company, as was then, which later become split up between S Company and headquarter company. That S Company was support company, were all the support arms, the anti-tank, heavy machine guns, flamethrowers, and all that were in.
So this was early 1943?
This would be 1943 now, yes, yeah, yes.
Any incidents that happened to you whilst you were at Westhoff?
No, the training was hard. It was a very big battle area, Westhoff, and still is today, of course. And we did very long hours, 12 hours a day, 6 and 7 days a week, on exercises. We trained very, very hard. And, of course, the 4th SLI were part of 159 Brigade, which was part of the 11th Armoured Division, which had only been formed in 1942. It was a new division. And most of our training was done with tanks. We were the infantry supporting the tanks. And we trained so hard that eventually that training proved to be a great asset to us.
What were you told about cooperation between infantry and tanks?
We learned all that cooperation between infantry and tanks.
But what specifically were you told to do?
Well, the main thing was that when you're in battle, the tanks are frightened of anti-tank guns. We were frightened of machine guns. So we could pinpoint anti-tank guns to the tanks, because they were all very often closed down and just looking through a visor, whereas we were out in the open, and we could see the flash of an anti-tank gun. And on the back of the tank, there was a small box, and inside there was a telephone set. You pressed the plunger, and that went straight through to the tank commander, and you could talk to him in normal language, tell him where the anti-tank guns were. On the other hand, you could tell him where the machine guns were as well, and then he could deal with the machine guns. So this was all the cooperation, all the time. Mainly, when an attack went in, The tanks went in front, you followed, and then once the ground had been taken, you consolidated and the tanks pulled back into harbour because they were very vulnerable at night, tanks were. They didn't like fighting at night, although they did fight at night, but they didn't like fighting because they were so vulnerable. They couldn't see very far, you see. And owing to the fact that turret commanders were being sniped at very badly, they kept the turrets closed down, so they were really locked in a box, as you might say.
Did that system of pressing the plunger down and speaking to the tank commander work well?
Yes, very well. I mean, sometimes the thing was out of action, but then you had to find other ways of doing it then, which was clamber up on the tank and speak to him, you know, direct. That was the only way you could do it. But that didn't happen very often, because most of our tank commanders did keep the turrets open, and you could see the tank commander, so you could shout to him and point to him. Although in battle there was so much noise going on that it was mainly directing him with signals, arm signals and things like that, you know.
How did you like being in Westhoff's area?
It was very lonely there because the nearest town was Brandon, which was about 6 miles away, and Thetford was about 11 miles away. We walked into Thetford many, many times and walked home again on a Saturday night, 11 miles each way. We did that quite often. We did it on Christmas Day, actually, 1943 that would have been, wouldn't it? Yes, Christmas 1943.
What did Thetford have to offer?
Well, there were plenty of pubs and a couple of naffies there, and that was what we didn't. We had a naffy on the camp, which was quite a basic. We used to do suppers and tea and things like that.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, the battle area was a very big training area. I think it was about 30 square miles. And every road that led into the battle area was governed by a barrier which had a red hurricane lantern hanging on it. And one of the duties that we used to have when we were duty company was go around and collect all those. There were about 30 different roads going into that area, and we used to have to collect those lamps in a 15 underweight truck, take new ones out, bring the old ones in, and in the afternoon your job was to trim those lamps and fill them ready for next day, because they were done every day. Only a lamp would only last 24 hours. And that was one of the jobs we used to have to do there.
What was the purpose of the lamps?
To stop people going into the battle area. It was on the barriers. Today, they're still there, but they've got electric lamps on the barriers today. I was there about 3 years ago, and they have electric lamps on them today. But we eventually left there, and we moved north, and we went up to Hornsey in Yorkshire. And we did our training then on the Yorkshire Wolds. And we were up there then for quite a long time. And eventually we moved from Yorkshire to Inverary in Scotland.
Can you give me any details about being in East Riding of Yorkshire?
Dates, you mean?
No, any things that happened to you there?
No, we just went on training. We lived in a boys' school. They'd taken over a boys' school as the barracks on the edge of the town of Hornsey. And we carried on training practically every day.
What was the Yorkshire Wolds like as an area to train?
Oh, it was good. Very good. Very good. Very good. We did a lot of very big exercises up there, even up to core size exercises.
So you were just doing exactly the same kind of training?
That's right, yeah. We carried on training for up until, I suppose it was April 1944.
What did you do at Inverary?
Inverary was done, it was combined ops training where we did landings from the landing craft. We were up there for about 3 weeks. And we did. We used to go aboard the landing craft and go across Loch Foyne, which is a very big loch, and land on the banks of the loch, the opposite side, and put attacks in. It was all a military area. And
how efficient were the troops at landing on beaches during that training?
Well, they used to do wet landings and dry landings. Very often the barges would come into towards the shore, drop the ramps, and away you'd go, and you'd step off into probably 3 foot of water. You had to go ashore, and of course you were wet through, but you had to carry on fighting. They had NCOs who wore white armbands who were umpires, and they would umpire it, and they would come along and tap you on the head and say, right, you're dead, lie down, and things like this, you know, because that would simulate what you were going to get when you landed in Normandy or wherever you were going to land. We didn't know where we were going to land then, of course. But we did 3 weeks there, and then we came back to Hornsey. Shortly after that, we moved from Hornsey to Aldershot. This was for the concentration for D-Day, of course, the start of the concentration. And we were in Aldershot we were in Aldershot on D-Day. I happened to be on main gate guard on the night of the 5th of June. And the barracks we were in was one of the old barracks there. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, I was on the main gate and I heard this roar. And I looked up and there was this massive, just getting light, this massive planes, gliders, going overhead. And I called the guard commander and he came out and he said, oh my God, we shan't be here very long. And that day was a battalion holiday. The 6th of June was the battalion holiday to celebrate the Battle of Blenny in the First World War, which is still carried on today. And when the 4th Battalion won the Croix de Guerre for their action on Hill Blenny in the First World War. And everything was cancelled. There was going to be a sports day, a dancing at night, and all sorts of things. That was all cancelled. And we had to pack up, and within 2 days we'd left there and were down in Hayward's Heath, in the confined camp at Hayward's Heath. And D-Day being put back by 24 hours, we were there for an extra day than what we thought we were going to be. And then we went by truck down to the coast and onto the ship. We pulled out of the harbour and we were there for about 24 hours before we actually started to move. By now it was about D plus 6. And we landed on the coast of Normandy at the little village of Aubin-sur-Mur, which is near Courcelliers, on the afternoon of the 13th of June.
What was your crossing like?
Fantastic. I mean, there were so many boats, you could have literally walked from boat to boat and got to France. One of the things we couldn't understand were these tugs pulling these great concrete boxes, as we thought they were. Of course, this was part of Mulberry Harbour, which we knew nothing about. Nobody had ever mentioned Mulberry Harbour to us. We didn't know what was happening. When we landed, we came off the boat onto what they called rhinos. And these were great big steel boxes, which were worked by the Royal Engineers. They had outboard motors, which they could... It was just stood on this big steel box, and this big steel box moved into the coast, and then you got off. Well, they tied up alongside a sort of a pier, which was literally these steel boxes bolted end on end, floating out from the beach. And they pulled up alongside, and half the company got off. And we broke away, and they pulled round, and the rest got off except me. It broke away again, and eventually when I got on the shore, there was nobody on that shore at all. I was totally on my own, and I looked up, and I thought, well, where is everybody? And I walked up, and I met a CMP, a military policeman, and I said to him, which way did the troops go? And he said, just follow the tapes. Don't get outside the tapes, because they were still mines, of course. And eventually I caught up with the rest of the company. We moved inland to a little village, which was so small, if you blinked, you missed it. And we were there for about 10 days. in an orchard, because we were waiting for the bridgehead to get big enough to be able to manoeuvre an armoured division. Because we didn't go into action until 10 or 12 days after. And the first action we did was called Operation Epsom, was the first action, which was to try and capture a very high hill in Normandy called Hill 112, which on its side that we were attacking had the small village of Baron de Orne. And we had to cross two rivers, the River Odon and the River Orne, to get there, which were only very small. You could literally wade across. And by the time we got to the base of the hill to move up towards the little village of Baron, it was dark. And we never had no problems at all. We did get lost, but somebody came and found us, and we eventually dug in on the hill in front of the village of Baron. Next morning, we realised where we were, and it was very quiet. There was hardly anything going on until about mid-morning, and then it was obviously the Germans had found out where we were, and then it started. And for the next 7 days, we were shelled and mortared unmercifully. Counterattacks came in every day, and it was so severe there that the artillery, who were behind us, of course, they started shelling one evening at 11 o'clock, and they never stopped until 5 o'clock next morning to hold this German counterattack. And they promised us that if we would stick on this base of this hill and hold this line, that they would send back five for every one shell that the Germans sent over. They'd send back five, and I think they must have done. It was almost... You couldn't hear yourself speak. It was such a noise. Because the shells were landing within 100 yards of us and sweeping up onto the top of this hill. And also, there was something going over the top, which we had no idea what it was, like an express train. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, there was a hedge behind our position, and somebody emerged from the hedge who we thought was a German, because he had what would look like a German helmet on. In actual fact, it was the FOO, the Forward Observation Officer, of one of the artillery regiments, named Captain Peter Garrett. And he came over to our trench and he said, "What do you think of the artillery?" I said, "Fantastic." I said, "But what's this going over the top like an express train?" He said, "That's one of the big battleships firing at extreme range of 23 miles. And they were firing 16-inch shells. And they were landing on the ridge just in front of us, you know, probably about a quarter mile away." And he said, "At 5 o'clock, this barrage will stop. But if so much as one shot is fired out there, I shall bring it all back down again." And he had his radio on, and at 5 o'clock, everything went quiet. And suddenly there was a couple of machine guns opened up in the front, and he called it all back down again for another quarter of an hour. And next morning, our medics went out and they picked up about 150 dead Germans in the corn, because it was all cornfields. And there was over 150 killed and about 150 to 200 wounded, which they brought in as prisoners of war.
Were there any casualties amongst your men?
Oh, yes. Where you were? Oh, yes, yes. From the German shelling, this was. Yes, we were there for 7 days on that ridge. And we lost about 27 men killed in the battalion. And the wounded, you can almost double the wounded, I suppose. We had around about 50 wounded there. Yeah.
How frightening was all this?
Oh, terribly frightening. We'd never been in action before. It was our first baptism of fire, of course, you know. We didn't actually do any fighting, because we just took the position. And the Germans had pulled back, obviously, and they were firing from over the other side, the Hill 112. So we didn't realise what a prominency this hill really was until much later in 1974, when I went back to Normandy, and I went onto the top of Hill 112. You can see for about 40 miles all round, so you can just see what a a terrific place this was for the Germans to lose. I mean, from there, they could see, you could see the beaches almost from there, you see. Yeah.